Hey everybody, welcome back. Why Bitcoin Podcast, joined today with Nuclear Bitcoiner Ryan. Welcome to the show. How you doing, man?
Great. Thanks for having me, Jeff. It's always great to talk to another pleb about this intersection I find myself in between nuclear power and Bitcoin mining and the potential that it may have in the future.
Hell yeah, man. I'm excited to get into it. So let's start. This is actually where I want to start. I am a product of the Simpsons propaganda, thinking that nuclear was green goo that destroyed fishes and was very dangerous and smokestacks coming out of the sky and all evil things. And I've since finding Bitcoin realized, oh, that's not how it works at all. So can you on a basic level explain to me what nuclear is and how it works? Because I'll tell you the little tidbit that I found out that I was like, what the fuck? So in the Simpsons, there's those big stacks. And then apparently the output or whatever it is of nuclear, it's just water vapor. So that's what I've come to learn. Is that true? And then what else can you tell me? Just the general of how nuclear works.
Yes, that is 100% correct, that these stacks, cooling towers at a nuclear reactor, are basically just releasing steam to cool off the steam turbine cycle that they use to generate electricity. Because the general principle is that they use uranium refined into a specific orientation and enrichment. Different reactors use different enrichment levels and different orientations, but it's all the same general principle. But they assemble them into little pellets that are assembled into rods that then are assembled into bundles, and then they get put into tube channels that are within the heart of a nuclear reactor. And then when they are able to interact with each other, they interact with the neutron fields that exist within the nuclear reaction. So when a neutron reacts with a uranium nucleus, it will cause it to split into daughter particles that are other like radioactive elements that are different on the supply chain. So basically what is happening is the uranium is struck by the neutron and it transmutes into two or more different elements, and then it releases more neutrons. And the way that the chain reaction continues in the reactor is that at least one neutron is enabled to continue interacting with another uranium element, and then it will continue that chain reaction, releasing three, and then two will be absorbed and one passes on to another one, and that reaction sustains and it generates a lot of heat and energy. And typically for most reactors around the world, it's collected in water as the medium to absorb that heat, and then that heat is transferred through a heat exchanger to a steam turbine that then spins and generates electricity. And that is the general principle of a nuclear reactor. I'm sure I could have smoothed it out a little bit, but I don't explain it out loud very often. So it's,
That was good, man. I get that. So, okay, here's some more basic questions just so that we have a very ground level understanding. By we, I mean me. The water that you're heating up, is there anything special about that water? Is it salt water? Is it like super clean water? Or like, is it just regular fucking tap water? Does it matter?
Generally, you want like a demineralized type of water, something that's been purified so that there's the less contaminants, the better it is to interact with. Not only because of how it interacts with the core, but how it interacts with some of the metal components. It reduces corrosion if you have like the purified water that doesn't have any mineral in it that can negatively interact with critical components. So that is one. And then there is a different unique reactor type, the CANDU reactors that Canada is famous for producing and exporting around the world, uses what's known as heavy water, and that uses water in which the hydrogen molecule that is part of that is actually deuterium, and that is hydrogen that has an extra neutron attached to it. And the way that is special is that when it's interacting with the neutrons in a reaction, it doesn't absorb as many because it already has that neutron populating its nucleus. So whereas in the light water reactors that use normal water, just the water does act like a moderator itself, and it will absorb some of the neutrons from that reaction. Whereas in the CANDU reactor, because it uses the heavy water, it doesn't absorb as much neutrons. So they use different types of material to act as their absorbents and moderators for the neutron flux. But it also has the added benefit of enabling the CANDU reactors to use natural uranium that does not need to be enriched. So it can be, it only needs to be refined into the proper form factor for use as nuclear fuel. So, and then the third feature of the water is that when it does interact with neutrons and it does absorb those extra neutrons, that is where tritium is formed in this equation. And that has been in the media significantly recently because of the release of the tritiated water from the Fukushima incident, where they have many, many, many large containers of water on their site that they require to dispose of, in which they have filtered out all of the other contaminants except for tritium to incredibly low levels that are actually lower than the allowable, like, regulatory limits that the International Atomic Energy sets for, like, global safety exposure limits. So it's just the sometimes, like, the people that are opposed to nuclear, they can tend to exaggerate the risk that tritium poses as a health hazard to humans, especially in the very small concentrations and quantities that we're dealing with in that particular scenario. But it all stems from just people just have a poor understanding of the technology. They've been exposed to different media sources like The Simpsons or The China Syndrome or various other movies like Godzilla, where it portrays a very exaggerated vision of what nuclear is at this very extreme fantasy-like scenario. And sometimes people get attached to that, and it is hard to bring them back to reality if that is what they're first exposed to. When then you start presenting people with the real, like, data and information about nuclear power and, like, how it does benefit the people that work around these sites, that live in these communities, that benefit from the power, benefit from the jobs, that it is a tough nut to crack getting through to more popular consensus of both the technology.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I feel that. I think I feel like the tide is shifting, though, slowly but surely. Let me ask one more, like, idiotic question just for the dummies like me out there. So uranium, you know, this was another buzzword that I heard growing up, that, I don't know, the Middle East was going to have it and destroy us all with it, or it was some glowing green stick that you had to be super, super careful of. What is uranium? Where do we find it? How dangerous is it just out when it's just in its raw form? How much, what do we have to do to it when we mine it and all that sort of things? And is that still the main source, uranium? I feel like there's one more that I'm forgetting.
You're probably thinking about thorium. Thorium is another potential fuel. And then there's also, like, plutonium, but plutonium.
Plutonium, that's the one. That's the scary sounding one.
Plutonium doesn't occur naturally. It's a byproduct of the nuclear fission process. It will, it's one of the transmutations of the uranium-238 element. It can become plutonium-239. With the various nuclear interactions that it has inside of the nuclear
reactor. So is uranium on the periodic table of elements? It's just one of those things?
Yeah.
Or neither of these things are? Oh, it is. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So
What does it look like out in the wild?
It's just like a rock, just like so many other things that any other mineral that we mine for, like, as a productive commodity. Like, it's mostly found in basins that kind of collect because of the natural, like, water flows, where it's soluble in water. So many of the deposits that exist around the world were in places where that water collected and was allowed, and just the natural chemistry enabled the uranium to come out of solution and solidify in these like large deposits. And particularly in northern Canada, in this is northern Saskatchewan area, there's a significant deposits which are considered some of the most like highly concentrated uranium ore bodies in the world. And then there's significant deposits like Australia has huge amounts of uranium deposits. There's significant amounts all throughout Africa, in which that's where much of the French reactor fleet obtains its fuel. Russia obtains a lot of its fuel from Kazakhstan, and they also have some of their own uranium deposits. And yeah, once you've obtained it, like legacy, it and the older style, it was basically similar to kind of open pit mining, where they would dig the ores and then they would put them through the various chemical processes to refine them into a purified metal form that can then be used conveniently in a power reactor. But modern methods enable them to use what's known as an acid leaching technique, and it's a lot cleaner, in which they'll drill holes above the deposits, and then they allow the acid to flow through the deposit, and it will dissolve the uranium, and then that will continue flowing through into a cavern that they've actually dug underneath the deposits. And then they have the chambers underneath that can collect the fluid that comes out, and then they send that to the further processing facilities. And that is the yellow cake that many people have heard of, is basically just raw mined uranium in the kind of a slurry acidic form, and then that gets sent to a several steps of refining facilities, where they'll it takes multiple steps, and then it eventually gets made into fuel rods that we generate electricity from. And then the cool thing about them is, because they are like the main component of the nuclear power byproducts, is the fuel rod. When it comes out of a reactor and it's been exposed to radiation, it has significant radiation fields that need to be protected from. So exposure to something like that is a very negative consequence. So all of the very strict measures are taken to use tools that shield the workers using that are extracting these fuel bundles from the reactors. They can do it in a safe way, and then those rods will typically be stored in the spent fuel pools, and then they are left there to cool off with recirculating water for 5-10 years. And then once the fastest decaying materials, which are also the most harmful ones, are the ones that decay faster, because if they are releasing more radioactive like decay particles, but because of the nature of radiation, that makes them break down into safer, more stable forms of materials over a period of time. So within 10-15 years, these rods are typically safe enough to transfer into dry cask storage, which is just a large concrete lined canister, many of them about 8, maybe 12, 15 feet tall, and they store about a dozen, two dozen fuel bundles in them, depending on the style and the design and which country we're talking about. But then generally those are just stored in a big open space on site. And overall, the total volume of the material that needs to be shielded from is quite minuscule in the grand scheme of things for how much power it actually generates. Like, we can store the entire capacity of the nuclear fleet from the United States on two football fields stacked about 2 to 3 telephone poles high. So it's actually a very small footprint, and in the grand scheme of things, we will also be able to develop technology that will probably be able to extract all kinds of rare elements from that transmutation process that happens inside the reactor, and just generally over time as this material breaks down and becomes other elements, just because of the natural like radioactive decay process. So it's a another one of those tough things to explain to people because it's not something you can really capture in a quick soundbite, but because the opposition like frame it as like
I think you're
hundreds of thousands of years and trying to like say that that's not the case, like it becomes safer over time, and it's also a lack of faith in humanity's capability to adapt to this technology. Yeah, dealing with anti-nuclear people is a very weird challenge these days because they've gotten very aggressive as it seems that the tide has been turning in nuclear's favor, and combating their FUD is easier in some ways, but it's not in others.
Let me we'll get to all of that. I'm curious because it seems like you're deep into it, but I want to know a little bit more about you, man, because you seem very excited when you're talking about nuclear energy, which I love because that's how I am when I'm talking about Bitcoin. So how did you fall into this nuclear rabbit hole that you're in? Where did it start? Were you like a super science kid when you were in high school, or when did you fall into this nuclear life of yours? And did you have like some crazy aha moments? Do they just keep happening? Is it very similar to what people describe as a Bitcoin rabbit hole where you're just like, oh shit, this changes everything? Like tell me a little bit about your experience in understanding what nuclear is and what it can do.
Yeah, I didn't really fully appreciate the value of nuclear until I figured out Bitcoin. But like, I've been actually working in the nuclear industry for almost 10 years now. I became a chemical technologist. I probably could have gone to university, but I only went and just took a technical degree at a community college and become a chemical technologist. That I work in a laboratory. Working in a nuclear laboratory is a pretty sweet gig, especially in Ontario. So I ended up with a job at the Canadian Nuclear Laboratories, which is our equivalent of like the Idaho National Laboratories, their Argonne National Laboratories, Los Alamos, the equivalent of all of those facilities, but just the Canadian version. So what I do specifically is I support the corrosion monitoring of the CANDU pressure tubes. So every spring and summer, one or two of the reactors from the Ontario fleet, sometimes from the rest of the global fleet, because there's CANDU reactors in Argentina, Romania, China, South Korea, and I'm probably missing at least one of those. They take samples from inside of their pressure tubes, and then they get sent to my laboratory, and we monitor how much hydrogen and deuterium hydride buildup has corroded in the pressure tubes. And after a certain amount of time, once it reaches a certain threshold, they consider that a critical limit, and they will change out that piece of pressure tube with something new. And right now, almost the entire Ontario nuclear fleet is undergoing refurbishments where they are completely replacing all of the pressure tubes with brand new pressure tubes that will last for at least another 40-ish years, extending the lifetime of our fleet here in Ontario, which is quite amazing. But I came here just as a great job, supporting my family, and just something, a career that I can, if I choose to, I can ride this out for until I decide to retire. Or that gives opportunity to explore other different avenues within the nuclear industry. So I get to interact with a lot of people doing materials research, like thermal hydraulics, reactor, like neutron calculations and modeling, hybrid energy system modeling. Like there's a lot of interesting research that goes on at a nuclear laboratory. Like much of it is directed towards nuclear, but a lot of it is related to like tangential technologies that will be work in conjunction and integrate very well with nuclear power and nuclear heat systems. And then it was, around the time that I learned Bitcoin. Like I should have learned Bitcoin. I have the same experience as almost everybody else, 2011, 2012, the End the Fed movement, and seeing like Max Kaiser and some of the content back then. And then I had a small amount of Bitcoin that became a large amount of Bitcoin from cashing out from a poker site in, I don't know, 2018. And then in 2021, that run up in January, caught my attention, and then I started to take it seriously. And then very quickly, I learned about mining within a few months. And then in a conversation with my wife, around the same time that Elon Musk was complaining about the types of power that Bitcoin mining uses, and then the market had crashed in April, May-ish, my wife was the one that actually proposed the idea, because I've been telling her about all these great ideas of how mining can work and what they're doing in the oil fields and stranded energy. And she's like, well, and if they have complaints about, oh, it uses coal plants and natural gas sometimes, why don't we mine more of it with nuclear and small modular reactors? Because the site that we're working on is going to host one of the first of a kind micro reactors that's going to be brought onto the market, hopefully within the next 5-6 years. And then she kind of just went about her evening and went back to her book, and I just became enamored with this idea, and I basically stole it from her, and I've been running with it and promoting it, and I've been doing podcasts, a few conferences, promoting it within the company to, yeah, just start mining Bitcoin with nuclear power and take advantage of it, because like at this point it's not going anywhere. So if we can figure out ways to use it to our advantage as a very versatile anchor load that can just support a power project, whether it be nuclear or anything else, in remote communities and remote locations, remote mines, or in all kinds of different applications that we can start to think of. But it opens up a lot more versatility, knowing that we can just bring a demand with us that doesn't have constraints on like physical limitations like storage or transportation. We can completely amortize the product of the output of mining Bitcoin from anywhere in the world, as long as we have a power source. And now we are very close to having nuclear technology that we can build the power sources wherever we want. Like, we're not limited to where the best sun shines and where the best wind blows, or where we can build the best hydroelectric dams. And if there is a concern about using hydrocarbon-based power sources, then nuclear is really left as the only option to start displacing them from power and heat applications. Like, I don't really foresee us completely forgoing fossil fuels, hydrocarbons, and petrochemical products in the foreseeable future, because it's so integrated in so much of our life, and like 90% of the things that I look around and see in this room have some element of a petrochemical in them. And I'm sure there are viable alternatives. Like, I've read a lot about hemp and its promise of replacing some things that we use for petrochemicals, but yeah, it's so embedded that, like, yeah, maybe we can get them out of power and heat, maybe transportation, and let's go for like that low-hanging fruit. But we're also still going to need to be extracting and refining a lot of these petrochemicals as well, and that is done with electricity and heat. So instead of using gas and coal or oil to extract gas and oil, we can start using nuclear power to do that. And that's one of the plans that Alberta actually has. They have an interest in developing a nuclear program, which historically they don't. Only Ontario and New Brunswick in Canada have nuclear programs. So Alberta and also Saskatchewan signing on to having an interest in nuclear power is a very welcome development. But Alberta specifically wants to deploy them throughout the oil sands to support their oil extraction and oil refining processes. And that will very strategically reduce a lot of the emissions that come from those industries. And then, because we're not using the gas and the oil as like heat and fuel elements, even though what we get out of the refining of the oil to get many of the other products that we develop from that oil, like things like gasoline and kerosene, like these are byproducts that are going to happen anyways. So it does put us into like a catch-22, because like now we're still going to need many other products, but now we're going to have gasoline that's being built up because it's still a byproduct. But if we're not using gasoline for cars because we're transitioning to electric vehicles, it's going to do weird things to the gasoline market. Like, it may actually like put really depress like gasoline prices in a really weird, unexpected way. And there's going to be all kinds of weird unintended consequences that I can like foresee as we start to displace petrochemicals from much of our life. But if you're going to go by the narrative that we're being sold, that we have to just move away from this these technologies in order to prevent a potential catastrophe in the future, then we're going to have to really realistically consider the trade-offs of what that means. And also, what if they are wrong? Like, what if this is going to happen anyway? What if the narrative that climate change is happening and it's man-made and we're affecting it and we're making it worse? Like, yeah, I've read lots of evidence that does support those ideas, but like, I also have read lots of history about consensus gone wrong. And yeah, like, what if they're wrong? Like, how do we hedge our bets? Are we going to completely displace this reliable power systems that we have before we're prepared to have something to replace it with, like, nuclear power? Like, if we're going to power all of our transportation and all of our heating and displace all of our petrochemicals, like, across the board, like, that's going to require a lot of nuclear power. That's going to require a lot of transmission and infrastructure if we're going to be building a lot of that with windmills and solar panels. And those are also, we're going to be requiring batteries. And then they have all their own trade-offs that go along with that. And yeah, I don't know if we're going to be ready for the consequences of a rapid decarbonization if the people that are really pushing for it and putting a lot of money behind it actually manifest what they're trying to do. And I don't think that the consequences are going to bode well for us if we have a very extreme costs of energy and electricity and rolling blackouts in places like the North America and Europe, where things are already quite contentious and divisive across the board. Taking away critical infrastructure like that at a time like this is only going to exacerbate the worst problems and impulses that we are already experiencing. So, that was a pretty good rant.
So, do you feel like, so like, as Bitcoiners, we feel like we're kind of in a race to get as many people on board with Bitcoin before fiat inevitably collapses. Do you feel like nuclear people are in a race to get as many nuclear factories up and running before whatever the man, whoever's in charge, starts turning off all the coal plants and all the oil and gas, and it's just like complete damnation happens if we're just trying to focus on solar and wind? And if nuclear can, like, just keep up the pace, maybe it'll be a smoother transition. Is that kind of where your head's at?
Yeah, like,
or do you think maybe the coal people just fuck off and we just keep that shit anyways? You know what I mean? Like, they could just lose that battle, but I don't know. Yeah, what do you feel? Sorry.
Yeah, well, like, nuclear's definitely got to get its act together. It's definitely got to get its PR game together. And we definitely have to take advantage of where we have things actually in order. Like, the project that happened in Vogtle, was it definitely had some flaws to it. There was, like, re-engineering on the fly and having stuff that was already built. Like, they poured rebar in concrete, and then it wasn't to the correct tolerance, so it had to be completely destroyed and then redone. And that was a huge project because they're pouring concrete that's able to withstand impact from aircraft. So there's a lot of rebar, and they decided that instead of trying to get it relicensed to the way that it was built within the tolerances that they had it, which were still really tight tolerances, but they decided it was actually cheaper to destroy it and rebuild it than try to go back through the licensing process. And, like, that is how arduous and painstaking some of these processes are to get these reactors built, especially because it was a first of a kind reactor. They hadn't built one in America yet, and they hadn't fully put together the plans before implementing. So there was some work on the fly that had to be shifted in real time, which led to some cost overruns, led to some build time overruns, but they finally did get it over the finish line, and they have a brand new AP1000 in Georgia. Now they should take advantage of the fact that they have kind of reconstituted their construction capabilities and their engineering capabilities to build a mega project like this and parlay that into, let's build another one, let's build a set of them, let's serialize this reactor design and get it out there. Like, there are other countries internationally, like Poland, that is interested in buying this technology and deploying it for themselves because they see what's going on in their neighborhood. Like Germany, giving us all an example of, like, when you shut your nuclear plants down and you rely on the weather, eventually you have to turn your coal plants back on. And that is kind of counterintuitive to the plan that they say that they have set out to do, but it does not seem to be working out as favorably as many had intended. So there's an opportunity for Germany to turn their nuclear reactors on, but it is kind of a ticking clock because every day that they're not turned on, that's less people that would see an opportunity to go into nuclear power as a career. Anybody that was working in nuclear power is going to go on and find other careers and not likely come back, even if they do restart their reactors. And it sets the clock back a lot the more they delay on changing their minds. And so a lot of the neighborhood in Europe is seeing what's going on, and they are thinking energy sovereignty is the name of the game these days, and everybody wants to ensure that they have a power generation technology that they can confidently supply fuel for a long duration where they will not have to rely upon just-in-time supply chains like many of the natural gas infrastructure it relies upon, where that seemed to bite a lot of Europe in the ass when Russia pulled the plug when they incurred upon Ukraine. And then just that whole situation has caused everybody to reassess their energy sovereignty situation and who they want to rely upon for their power needs, like allies, enemies, themselves. It's gotten the whole world to start questioning some of these narratives where reliability is being sacrificed in the name of these high ideals of, well, we can generate all of our electricity without generating carbon. But some of the countries don't have the luxury of having huge hydroelectric infrastructure, and or large, high quality swaths of land where you can build windmills and solar panels. So they are dependent upon what is available to them. And many of these countries, most of the world, still relies upon oil, gas, and coal. So if we want to help them if we want to help them come up to the rest of the world, like, let's get them onto nuclear. Like, it's another one of those opportunities. Like, if you think about how, like, Africa kind of skipped the telephone landline era and jump right into cell phones, like, we can almost do that with this next generation of nuclear reactors that are smaller and applicable to a lot wider range of grid sizes, and basically skip the mega grid model into the more distributed microgrid model for, like, jurisdictions like Africa, because they don't have well-developed infrastructure. So that we can take it as an opportunity to leapfrog them again, just like we did with cellular technology.
Let me ask you this. Is there, so in Bitcoin world, right, we all see El Salvador. We're all going to watch it flourish, most likely, you know, I guess to be determined. But if you're a Bitcoiner, you kind of feel like, okay, that country's going to be miles ahead of everybody else within the next decade or two. They're just going to be crushing it. Is there anywhere in the world right now that is heavily reliant and working with nuclear that is like the test net for a nuclear powered city? Because I haven't heard of one, if there is. Or is there anybody that's trying to do that right now?
Well, like, there are many large cities that have a nuclear power plant nearby, like Toronto, Ontario, and the greater Toronto area, and a good chunk of, like, the Niagara Peninsula is powered by the three reactor sites that they have in the vicinity, the Bruce, Pickering, and Darlington. And then, like, if you sliced Ontario in half, like, kind of a north-south, the north is predominantly on hydro, and then the south is mostly nuclear, a little bit of hydro, natural gas plants for peaking, and then there's some solar and wind scattered all over the place that just, it does its thing. But, like, there are serious proposals to let some of our reactor capacity retire and replace that with wind and solar generation, which that's a whole other rabbit hole that, yeah. But as far as like plans to kind of from the ground up, put a nuclear power plant and then if you build it, they will come. There's like ideas that are floating around like that. I don't see anything like being implemented yet. Like that would be really a cool idea. And I think that something using a technology like Bitcoin mining as a placeholder gives us kind of the opportunity to kind of play around with that idea and kind of plant seeds. It's just like we can put a nuclear reactor somewhere where we want to develop, but haven't quite yet. And then try different models of how we can let it flourish, whether like, I don't know, try building a planned community or see how it would like grow naturally, like some of the old communities where it was just, it started with one building at just one stop along a river and then another, and then another. And then before we know it, there's like some giant multi-million people cities popping up around these little places that were just like a pit stop on the way from one place to another 200 years ago. Like it would be really cool to start planting seeds like that, where we can just drop a generating station and build like somewhere where we know that there's a resource and start building communities around it. Like we kind of have that in a way with some of like the mining communities in like northern places, but it's not sustainable to bring like more than just pretty much who's working in those facilities. But if we were to have a better power source that's not nearly as expensive as like imported diesel, then potentially we could attract more people to these like northern communities. And then like I foresee like thinking on like the humanitarian side, like especially Canada's plan is we want to build micro reactors and we want to upgrade the entire north off of diesel. Like that is our long-term multi-decade game plan. And there's like a few communities that are already kind of interested in the idea. There's a whole bunch that are just NIMBYism, don't bring that technology near us, mostly not just poor understanding. It's just in it. It is a tough thing to communicate, especially across language barriers and cultural barriers and different exposures to the technology throughout the years. But I think it would be an interesting opportunity to showcase in the North. Like once we have proven out the technology, that will open up some really interesting use cases for these communities where now with the availability of that power, they will be able to have better infrastructure, whether it be like water, education, healthcare systems, sanitation, and just in general, just better infrastructure that will reduce many of like the worst like mental illness epidemics that we have, because like a lot of people in these communities, they're trapped in cycles of meaningless, and then that results in substance abuse and all the negative consequences of just not seeing a bright future. And many of the brightest minds of these communities, like anybody that has the opportunity to leave them will leave them, and they don't want to be like trapped in those cycles of poverty. And it is despairing that like there's always, like every cycle, the politicians are trying to placate to like, yes, we're going to serve the most like disadvantaged communities in our culture. And they talk a big game when it's election time, and then nothing ever really seems to manifest. So it is really disappointing. And like, I don't think the solution is going to come from politics. It's going to come from like a lot of like private capital seeing an opportunity to like really develop a part of the world where we can unlock a lot of human capital that if they stay and develop where they are, like in their own like cultural image, then it'll just bring so many more people and minds and as part of the global community, because not only will they have good power, but then unlocking Bitcoin for them, that it just taps them directly into a global marketplace where they can now literally, where did I actually have it written down? Yeah, they can literally like, they can harness the electricity locally and then they can transact with it globally. And we can, because now we can dream up the perfect electricity customer for any profile. And then we do have more sophisticated energy consumers. Like, we're going to use these nuclear reactors for hydrogen production, desalination, many other chemical processes. Like, Dow Chemical is talking about developing an SMR that's going to be predominantly used for them just on site. Like some of the way that they might even be talking is like their chemical facility is going to just like be built with the nuclear reactor as a part of it, as just one giant facility. And
okay, let me slow you down here for a second. Sorry. Man, I want to understand one thing. So with the nuclear reactors or the factories, wherever they are, if somebody wanted to whip up a hydro dam, right, you have to be beside the waterfall, obviously. So if I just wanted to whip up a nuclear generation plant, could you pop one anywhere and then you just import the raw materials, or do you go to where the raw materials are? How would that work? Like, you can't just make a nuclear plant anywhere, can you?
Well, after you consider like seismic stuff and different environmental limitations, in theory, we can place nuclear reactors anywhere as long as the environment is safe for it. So we don't want to put it somewhere where there's going to be obvious flooding, obvious earthquakes, like that typical stuff. We don't want to put one near a volcano that may erupt for obvious reasons. But some of the new technologies also open up the opportunity to build nuclear reactors where we don't need significant bodies of water, especially some of the smaller ones that'll be gas cooled. The intention is that they will have a much smaller requirement for water, so that, well, exactly, like they won't need to be near a big body of water. I forgot where I was going with that.
I was just asking where you can put these nuclear plants if you wanted to.
In theory, anywhere.
Environment they need.
Yeah, like I said, just as long as the environment's safe.
But then you would have to import the uranium or whatever it is that you're using for the nuclear power. Like, what? How's that stuff? You just toss a bunch of it in a truck and then ship it off where you need it, or how does that work?
Not quite that simple, but that's the general idea that they want to work towards, where they can build the reactors predominantly in a manufacturing type of facility where they can mass produce the main components. So like under 30 megawatts, the expectation is that they will be able to build these reactors in a way that they can ship it almost fully assembled and deliver it to site and have it operating within a few months. And that is barring the site would already have to be environmentally qualified and licensed. Other than that, they would need to consider I'm just losing track. I got distracted by my cat.
It happens, bro. It happens. Yeah, man, I don't know. It just seems like
that's what I'm talking about. The way that they're assembled,
it seems like it's too good to be true, sort of thing.
But basically, yeah, they want to set them up so they can assemble them in a factory, and then the smaller ones they'll send to site fully assembled. The slightly larger ones they'll build multiple components that then can be assembled on site. So they're trying to minimize the amount of parts that need to be assembled at the final construction site. That is, that's where I was trying to go with that, and the larger they get, the more sophisticated they will be. And like right now, most attention is being paid to the smaller version of the boiled water reactors because it's a technology that we're familiar with. It's technology that we're good at building, and we're good at operating it, at least for like the global nuclear fleet. Like, the West still needs to get its act together and redevelop its supply chains and its labor and construction capabilities around nuclear and take advantage of what was built in Georgia and build more. Ontario is definitely taking advantage of its CANDU refurbishment and is hoping to leverage that into building more nuclear reactors afterwards. At one of the Bruce sites, they want to build some new large reactors at one of the at the Darlington site. They want to use that for a first of a kind demonstration of one of these small boiled water reactors. That then, that's the GE Hitachi 300 megawatt boiled water reactor, and that is getting a lot of attention globally because there's a higher expectation of confidence that it will. It'll operate as expected pretty much right out of the gate because it's something that we're familiar with. Some of the other technologies, we don't want to exceed our expectations. We don't want to have excessive expectations for their performance because some of these technologies, there are still kinks to work out once we get the first of a kind building. Like there's a history of like the molten salt reactors not getting like a really sufficient capacity factor to justify like mass commercial production. And some of them never really reached more than like a research experimental phase. And there's other reactor technologies that they've been tried and they've been experimented with, but they're not as familiarized as we are with the boiled water reactor types. So there's probably going to be a few misses and delays as we start reaching the point where some of these more exotic and advanced reactor types reach their design maturity and start being deployed as first of a kind. But that is the whole point of building the first of a kind reactors at sites that are already familiar with nuclear technology. It gives us the opportunity to do the research and with people that are very capable of performing the troubleshooting that would be needed to work out any kinks that we may have. And yeah, some of them may end up being flops, but it's one of those things where we have to try as much as we can and see what happens. And if for every one that fails, if we can get one that succeeds, we are going to be in a really good place with a lot of opportunity for nuclear technology to proliferate in the future. And yeah, I would hope to see at least a few different designs succeed at the different kind of size categories and like different temperature output categories. That gives us a wider range of applications that we can bring nuclear technology towards. Because like many, 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 many things like, where did I have it? I have a nice chart here. Yeah, like pharmacy products, chemicals, mineral refining, mining, textiles, breweries and distilleries, freezing and cooling, greenhouses, food and beverage, like dairy, district heating, like all of these can use various degrees of temperature of heat that will be coming from these small modular reactors. Because typically the boiled water reactors that we have now, they max out around 300 degrees Celsius. So they're good for some applications. Like they're really great for district heating in some of the places where they're used in like Northern Russia and Northern Europe, but not great for things like mineral refining. But now that we are going to be deploying technologies that can get up more in the 800 to 900 degrees Celsius range, we can start getting into higher order industrial processes that use heat and high quality steam. So that is something that's very exciting for the industry to tackle those different applications. And then the one thing that I don't think I've mentioned at all yet is that nuclear, like medical isotopes, are one thing that can only really be developed from nuclear reactors. And we take advantage of the transmutation process where we can expose a material to the environment in the nuclear reactor, and then it comes out of the reactor as a completely different material. Like there's actinium 225 is one of the ones that they want to use for it's a targeted alpha therapy. And so that what they basically want to do is that's going to be one of the things that will be directly remote controlled towards a tumor, and they'll be able to expose only the tumor to a very controlled dose of radiation. And that's going to be one of the new therapies that they want to use radioactive isotopes for. And they also use like cobalt 60 is used for sterilizing single-use medical equipment. So just about anybody that's had any medical procedure in the last like 2 decades has probably had some exposure to instruments that have had this sort of sterilization technique. And then there's various other ones that are used as like tracers for detecting things in the blood. And so I think there's at least like 5 or 6 different medical isotopes that are produced in nuclear reactors, and many of them come from the CANDU reactor fleet here in Ontario. So that is one important thing that many people aren't fully aware of, that the nuclear technology is capable of, that many of the competing technologies can't really even do. Like there's ways that you can have like a controlled like neutron beam accelerator, but it's not quite the same as having a nuclear reactor where you can expose like safely various materials that can be transmuted into medical isotopes, which is pretty freaking cool.
That's insane, dude. That's fucking insane. Wow. Sorry to bring you back. I want to talk about, so nuclear produces a fuck ton of energy from what I understand. So my question that I'd want to understand better is there like, could you have an oversupply of energy, and then would you just be in the same situation of where solar and wind is, where they just need to have a bunch of batteries to store that energy? So is there like a fuck ton of batteries beside a nuclear plant where all the excess energy goes there? And is that where you think Bitcoin steps in, where you could just run Bitcoin miners? Is that kind of where your head's at with that one? Or can you shut down a nuclear plant easily if you're using too much energy? Or once it's running, it's running? Like, how does all that work?
Yeah, preferably you want, because of the massive upfront capital cost of building a nuclear reactor, you want to run it as often and as possible, maximize its utilization and profit as much as you can. So yeah, oversupply is definitely a liability, and sometimes they will curtail that. They can load follow, but not rapidly like a natural gas plant that is typically used as a peaker. They can tolerate a brief turn down for a few hours, and they can only ramp down a few megawatts per 5 minutes or so. So there are limitations on the speed and maximum capacity and the duration in which they can curtail their load. So there's the economic liability, and then of just not generating. So the opportunity cost of not generating electricity, but if it's not needed by the grid, you cause negative prices, and then that creates a situation where they would have to negatively price it for markets that would be attached to that generator. And what happens in Ontario when our nuclear fleet is at full capacity, it's not as large of an issue right now. Ontario generally generates a significant oversupply of electricity, and we export that to Michigan, New York, New Hampshire, Maine, and also Quebec also exports a significant amount, but they're mostly hydro. So a lot of these states that border Ontario have significantly taken advantage of our abundance of electricity, and that made it easier in some cases to justify shutting down some of their nuclear capacity. Indian Point and Pilgrim and Palisades are three that quickly come to mind as nuclear reactors shut down in that part of the United States. And what is happening, though, is that although Ontario and Quebec generally had a big oversupply, like right now Ontario has several gigawatts offline for refurbishment, and then it's also starting to spread thin Quebec's supply. So Quebec is electrifying a lot more of its infrastructure, so they're using a lot more of their electricity. And it was fine when you only had like a few customers to export to, but then when all of your neighbors start expecting similar exports, you start having to like prioritize or like basically force them to compete in a market where they're offering more electricity, to pay more for that electricity. But then it flips on its head. Like, yeah, sometimes there's oversupply, but then in the winter they need a lot more for themselves. So then there isn't that oversupply. So the places that were dependent upon that really cheap electricity when it was abundant and in excess. In the winter, it's not quite there. And sometimes even in the winter, Quebec has to import during some periods of the time. And often that will come from Ontario because of our nuclear fleet. But again, like at the moment, it's not at its full capacity. So it creates these weird dynamics where you have to really consider the ebb and flow of how an electricity market works. Like you have to manage your supply and demand almost perfectly with your own grid. And then if you're connected to other grids, you have to balance with that. And having a large grid does give you that benefit that when you do have that excess supply, you can just pump it out there to somebody else and someone else will take it at the right market clearing price. And sometimes that is zero or less than zero, which can be a liability. And depending on how the type of market that you're in, whether it's regulated or unregulated, like some utilities, they'll get paid a fixed market rate no matter what. Like they, I think the reactor utilities in Ontario get 7 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour, no matter what, regardless of what the market says. So when the price goes negative, that actually becomes a liability on the ratepayer and the taxpayers, because they're the ones that have to make up that shortfall and imbalance. And it creates all kinds of mismatches on the grid when there's not a good supply and demand mix. And then that's one of the places where the increasing penetration of wind and solar power is starting to make grids more complicated, because it's starting to have these generation sources that can bid very low into the markets because they are significantly supported by subsidies and tax credits, that it disrupts the baseload generation. And there was actually a graph that came out from ERCOT the other day that showed, like, in the morning the sun came up and just a straight line straight up, and you see the natural gas and the coal come down, but it also looked like the nuclear plant also came down a little bit to compensate for just the rapid influx of new generation that came online, because it all comes on at the same time, and it's predictable, but it's also just, it puts a lot more onus on grid management rather than on the generation side. Like, it's great and that you have free electricity that you can generate when the sun's shining and the wind's blowing. But now where you make up the costs on that is it all gets transferred to delivering that electricity to the customer, because that becomes significantly more complicated as you build more of this wind and solar infrastructure. It gets further and further afield, and then it's using lower quality like land and further from population centers, so then that requires more transmission infrastructure to bring it in. And then it's also doesn't synchronize well with the grid, because the grid is designed to have the thermal generation that has a spinning, like a large spinning mass attached to it in the turbines, and that creates like an inertial frequency in the grid that sustains in North America, it's 60 hertz, and other places of the world, it's 50 hertz. But that's basically just measures the flow of electrons over time through the transmission infrastructure. And when it deviates from that very narrow band, that can risk having blackouts and brownouts, because if it goes too high or too low, it can overload or underload the market. And well, the infrastructure, and have negative effects that need to be buffered. So there's many technologies that are used for frequency response that'll basically be able to react to that change, to a deviation from that primary frequency that they like to maintain. And that is one of the very finest demand response level that is available to these to power markets is maintaining at that frequency level within a few seconds. So like the first line of defense typically is the inertial momentum from the spinning turbines. They will typically be able to provide a few seconds of buffer if there's a significant disruption in the load. So like say like a power generator, a few hundred megawatts goes offline, the turbines will just by the natural physics of a large spinning object, they will slow down and contribute some of their stored inertial energy into the grid to compensate for the loss of frequency from losing a large generation source. And but that only buffers for a few seconds, and then there'll be like other things, like they can have capacitors that can absorb excess capacity if they need it, or if there's a way to they'll have, some of them have storage that they can flip on to make up for the shortfall. Some peaker plants are just run not at their full capacity so that they can ramp up quickly from like 70% to 100%. They participate in some of those programs. And so we're starting to see more and more influx of like the distributed computing into that to buffer this excess supply. And it is showing great promise because it's like a free market incentive to solve a problem in power markets and power systems that has plagued them since they've existed. It's like, how do you perfectly match supply and demand when you have to have enough supply available for the absolute highest demand that you could expect at the most extreme day of the year? So like in what happened in Texas, like we've seen them get pushed right to their absolute breaking limits a few times where they were on the verge of blackouts, and just from the influx of population and capacity, like the significant change from having a significantly more just base load and thermal capacity to having more intermittency on their grid, and just managing all that is it's starting to show its cracks at the extreme margins when the weather conditions really put it to the test. And you need to have that capacity available, but then under normal circumstances, it's not always being used. So then you need to have some way to make it more economical. And typically it'll just be natural gas plants that are just, we turn them off, we just keep them off. And like they're paid just to be available and off for 90% of the year sometimes. And then they will only turn on during those extreme events like the winter storm Uri and the recent heat wave that went through Texas. And so that becomes an expense on the grid that's just, it, we can completely flip to the load side by just having that excess capacity available with something like a really solid baseload generator, like a nuclear power plant, whether it's a big one or small one, and really depends on the size of your grid, whether it's like a large interconnection like ERCOT and the NERC and FERC and the Ontario grids. We can match that load as a flexible computing to perform the exact same function of the peaker plant, but instead of being off all the time, it's on all the time, but then it can turn off when we need that power available, instead of running a gas plant very inefficiently and trying to peak it up and down to follow like an extreme load. So it's creating a new dynamic that is, yeah, it's going to change things significantly, but we're only just starting to figure this out.
It seems like what you're saying is that the energy sector has many problems, and the answer is that nuclear fixes this. Is that pretty much what it is summed up? Like all the problems that humans have faced with energy and how we run it, what we do with it, and how we balance it, just nuclear solves a crap ton of those issues in such a simplistic way. Well, not obviously it's not simplistic, but when you break it down, it's just like such a better option in almost all aspects.
Oh, yeah. And it's the perfect arbitrage for electricity that you otherwise couldn't really use. And yeah, one thing that I want to mention while we're talking about the oversupply is many nuclear power plants, especially in the United States, were built in conjunction with hydroelectric dam nearby, somewhere that they had good hydro infrastructure, and they're all what's known as a pumped hydro facility. So what they do is when there's excess supply, they will run pumps to pump the water from a lower reservoir back up to the higher reservoir, so that the water reservoir is available as basically potential energy to run through the turbines during the times of higher demand. So it's essentially same idea of what they have with batteries right now, where they're going to fill the batteries when energy is cheap and then discharge the battery when energy is very expensive, because they'll, at a certain threshold, will trigger the batteries to activate and export their load into whatever grid that they may be attached to. And yeah, I foresee Bitcoin playing a similar role, like, and they're all going to work together. Like, we're building batteries, although the current technology may not quite be capable for some of the expectations that some people have for this whole like windmill, solar, and battery. But I like expect that we may have a breakthrough, and that could change things. And I'm not going to completely discount the possibility of that happening. But yeah, as it currently stands, battery technology has some maturing to do before it's ready to take on the loads that are expecting of it without something like nuclear in the mix. And yeah, combine these things like hydrogen, desalination, other chemicals, like build large industrial parks into ports that can build nuclear reactors and all of these supporting industrial processes that can go with it for export. Like, it creates a unique opportunity for the countries that have this technology. And it also opens up a lot more availability and approachability from markets where it wouldn't be appropriate for like a giant gigawatt scale reactor. And some places that's great, like where you do have the population, where you do have the industrial base. But then if like consider places like Africa, like they've got huge cities, but then as soon as you get away from the city to like the rural communities, like their grids are very scattered and very poorly connected. And a lot of their infrastructure was primarily built for resource extraction. It wasn't connected very well to the actual like local populations. So it's a very complicated situation to inject a large, like a very, very large power generation source, and it would be more appropriate to plop down like 80 megawatts, few hundred megawatts here and there to different like smaller like micro locations, and then possibly consider like as these places mature, build out the infrastructure where they can be connected to each other, and then like they can share capacity with each other. Because if you really think about it, electricity grids are basically just liquidity management of electrons. So the more nodes and channels that you can connect to each other, the more interaction you can have in these markets. And I see interesting similarities to just how the Lightning Network is coming together with just its nodes and channels in a digital space. But it maps on interestingly to electricity markets, except one's a static flow and one's like a constant dynamic flow. And then when you start thinking about things like once power generators like fully catch on to Bitcoin mining, and then they're mining Bitcoin, then they have to start thinking about things like, okay, now we're doing this. Bitcoin's a thing now. What can we do with it? We can start thinking about ideas like they can open Lightning channels and provide liquidity and provide those types of services. We're seeing different Lightning service providers pop up that are making that much easier for businesses to engage in and participate in that market. They can also do things like they can engage with companies and service products like what Sunoda is proposing, where that will enable customers of electricity to settle their utility bills in real time, basically the exact same way that we are using the Fountain app to stream sats during podcasts. It's a similar model, and with the smart meters, it would be just as simple as adding an application where you can have your own like Lightning wallet, and you can stream sats as you consume electricity, as you consume natural gas, as you consume internet bandwidth. Like, who knows where we can start taking this, but then that starts reducing a lot of accounting overhead if everybody in the value chain can then have that Lightning payment split right from like the distribution level through all of the different channels right back to the generator, and everybody gets compensated in real time as electricity is being consumed. Like, that, I don't know how that's going to change things, but it's definitely going to have a profound effect on the quality of our electricity systems. And then we start laying on to like what happens if now these companies are having Lightning coming to them from all these different directions, and they're going to have Lightning channels, and but then they're also going to have real world supply chains amongst other, like all these peripheral companies that supply parts and equipment and various other raw materials to build large power plants and sustain them and do operation and maintenance and labor on top of that. And so he could see this idea kind of forming where the generator has lightning channels, and then they can connect those to various companies in their supply chain. And then ultimately everything will come back to some power generator at some point. Cause like, let's use a company like Swagelok, for example. They make like metal fittings. So they would have raw material that they would have to pay for. So then we could have that channels going all the way back to there. And then those raw materials, we know that they're going to have an element of energy to produce them, electricity, some sort of like heat source. And every step of the way is going to have some form of electricity input into it. So that'll be another pathway that electricity producers and generators are getting paid through, like these lightning channels and the Bitcoin infrastructure. It's going to take a minute to adapt to like this completely new accounting paradigm, because like we don't have any models for it. And like I always find myself trying to come up with like analogies to explain this technology to people, but you always end up coming up short, because it's like a ledger, but it's not just a ledger. It does these other things, and it keeps track of this token, and there's only so many of them, and it's like gold, but it's scarcer than gold, and we've never seen digital scarcity before. And it's tough to explain these ideas when this is like the first time we're interacting with something like this.
I hear you, man. Dude, that's a lot. I was kind of going through my list of all the questions I had for you, and it kind of just kept ticking them off. So it's all good. Because, yeah, I was just, you know, your name is Nuclear Bitcoiner. So I was curious about how you see those two interacting. And I could see that happening, where I go back and forth with the streaming payments thing. I don't know if that'll ever catch on, or if it's necessary, or if that's a problem that needs solving. That's the question I find myself asking is, okay, so I pay my energy bill every month. Do I need to pay it every second as I consume energy? Does that, who benefits from that? Me, sort of, the energy company, sort of, but does it really? You know what I mean? So I guess we'll see what happens there.
It may not make sense at like a residential level. Like it'll definitely make sense for Bitcoin miners.
Like I see that.
Like it just, if it's made an option that's available, let the market figure it out. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
If we have the tools available and the UX is approachable to the average person, like, yeah, who knows? And if there's incentives, right, like financial incentives, like discounts, if you pay in that way, then yeah, maybe we'll see. Bitcoin definitely uses the carrot a lot more for leading people in the directions that favorable towards the better future for it and us as we interact with it.
Absolutely, man. I'm happy to have you on, man. You seem very optimistic about the future. It's going to be bright with Bitcoin. It's going to be even better if we get nuclear running. Is there anything else on your mind you want to get off your chest while we're here? Something you didn't touch on?
I don't know. I think we addressed the FUD pretty good. Like, I don't know, we didn't really talk too much about like capital markets. Like, that's an interesting one right now. Because the competitive technologies to nuclear got to experience the ZERP environment for a little while, and that seems to be drying up, and it's putting a lot of pressure on some of their financing channels, and some of these projects that had been proposed a few years ago are now being reconsidered because of this new environment. And then on the flip side, like nuclear has been stuck in this place where it's very high cost of capital to invest in a nuclear project. And it sucks, but that's kind of decades and decades of a very well-funded anti-nuclear movement really banging the drum about like every tiny little potential like safety risk and over-exaggerating all of these things that aren't actually issues. And it has created policies and investment frameworks where it gets lumped in like sin stocks with same categories of investing in like firearms companies and cigarette companies. And like in, that was where it was considered until maybe even 2 or 3 years ago here, even in Canada, where we have a robust nuclear industry. So it deters investment in the technology when the wider policy environment around it and is kind of putting impediments and disincentives from doing so. And now recently, like in Canada, that's been reversed. There's more favorable treatment towards nuclear, and it's starting to get better access to just better capital environments. And like, even if it doesn't go too much in like lower interest rates for acquiring capital for nuclear power, like just the fact that the competing technologies are starting to have to be in a more level playing field, we're seeing it play out more, where it does seem like investors are taking a longer time horizon and sanity is returning to these markets, and it's very a lot less like frothy and euphoric. Like it does feel like there may be an element of like the windmill and solar companies are may go through something similar to what crypto did in like the last 2 years, and just things got a little crazy. People got very excited. There was a lot of money flying around. Shit got built that really shouldn't have been built, that wouldn't have been profitable without money that shouldn't have been available in the first place. And I think a lot of that's going to start come crashing down, and some of these projects are going to face the reality that the money that they thought was available is not available. And then that creates an environment where they've become very like aggressively hatred towards any money that gets put towards nuclear power, because the argument that they have now is any investment in nuclear power is investment that is not going towards windmills and solar panels and batteries. And their argument for that is that the climate change catastrophe that we need to fend off is so imperative and it is so quickly forthcoming that nuclear power is too slow, and we have to put all of our eggs in the one basket right now so that we can stop using hydrocarbons by some arbitrary date in the next 2 decades or so, and completely transition away from gasoline powered cars. And it sounds very utopian and fantastical, but realistic it may not be when we're really starting to have to come back to like a more sane investment environment and financial environment that's being forced upon us by the banks actually kind of being responsible, like their mandate is. And I love the meme of like how did the banks destroy Bitcoin? Oh, by actually behaving responsibly. And then now they're doing that. And like in Canada, it is kind of funny because Pierre Poilievre, like our front runner for the Conservative Party and potentially winning the next election against Justin Trudeau. What the hell was the argument that he had made?
Is Pierre a big nuclear guy? I didn't know that about him.
He's not so much nuclear. He likes power.
It's the subsidies and how much money is going towards things that don't matter. And then we're going to see that conflict of what happens when all this subsidy money doesn't exist anymore and only real investments happen with the real capital. Where does it go? And that'll be the shift from solar and wind to nuclear, hopefully. And it seems like that's what's happening. If you take away all the fake money and you only have real money, what happens?
Yeah, as more of the roadblocks are pulled away from investing in nuclear, it seems to be pulling more people in that direction. And yeah, and like politics in Canada is weird right now. Politics everywhere is weird right now. And like, I hope we can kind of get over some of this divisiveness and not be so aggressive towards everybody. But yeah,
Bitcoin fixes that, man. It's gonna
I certainly hope so. Just and it's just, it feels like, yeah, just the world has gotten roughly 2% shittier every year, And we just don't notice it. It's like we're living in a fishbowl. It was clean water when we lived on a gold standard, and then we just slowly filled it with shit to the point that we don't even realize now that we're swimming in a shitty fishbowl. And now we have the opportunity. Like, that's why one of the things I love about Bitcoin, it's a completely new set of lens to view the world through. You can get out of the shitty fishbowl and actually see, like, oh my God, I was in a shitty fishbowl. And that's, the fiat is the shit, and we need to do away with it because it's a toxic technology that's corrupted so much of our culture. And like, reading through stuff like the fiat standard and like some of the stuff that Safedean puts out there, it does seem kind of unbelievable and fantastical until you start like digging into it, just how these bad incentives just leak into our society and just slowly corrupt and degrade the sanity of everything.
I know, it's fucking insane, man. If only we had, I feel like if Bitcoin is going to usher in a nuclear future, it's a shame that it couldn't have happened sooner, but at least we're on, it feels like we're on the right track now, right? Like we're course correcting, and that's a good thing, so I'm all for it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, if, I remember what I wanted to say about Pierre, because he was talking shit about the Bank of Canada and how like they left the interest rates for too low for too long, and that it was affecting and causing inflation, and then he was mocked for it by the liberals. And then the bank started raising interest rates, and then like inflation started coming down. And then he was getting mocked for just like, oh, you were wrong. That like, see, like everything's good now. But it almost feels like he was calling them out so they actually performed what they were supposed to do in response to somebody pointing out what they, their failures and inadequacies to actually properly manage the financial markets. And he takes a lot of shit for it, and he took a lot of shit for being into Bitcoin while it was roughly at its peak, and then it crashed and gets accused of people losing their life savings. You know, like, I don't know, if you put all of your wealth into one thing, I think that's kind of silly, unless you're one of those very unique, laser-eyed, completely get... No, they've gotten off zero, and now they've gotten off zero Bitcoin, and now they're on zero fiat, which is... impressive that we can have the tools and capabilities to do it, and like everyone, that's a goal to work towards. But yeah, it's tough in a fiat world these days. It's tough acting like a normie amongst people that they don't either don't see the rot in the world, or I don't know. I see what I see, and it's hard to unsee it now once you start seeing all the cracks.
Well, you're doing a hell of a job spreading the good word of nuclear, man. I think your role in whatever this Bitcoin story is that we're playing out is going to be a very important one. So I'm happy to help spread your signal, man, and keep up the good work. Keep telling people that everything they know about nuclear is wrong, and that there's a much better future ahead, because it's an important message. So I appreciate you coming on the show. Let people know where to find you if they want to find you, Twitter and anything else you want to shill.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great chat, as always. I love talking about this stuff, and like, it's like nuclear, it's not perfect, but it's pretty damn good. It's got trade-offs just like any other technology, and as long as we're realistic about comparing those trade-offs and approaching it like grown-ups and civil discourse and letting markets figure this stuff out and on merits instead of who can tell a better story, I think we're gonna see a bright future for nuclear power. And as for finding me, Nuclear Bitcoiner on X, on Noster, on the Orange Pill app, those are the three predominant social medias that I use these days for communicating in the Bitcoin space. Should be using Noster more. I keep telling myself that, but yeah, it's tough to get the nuclear people to come over, because I have to still follow people on X, because that's where all of the nuclear action still is, even though the Bitcoin signal is much better on Noster these days.
Fair enough, man. Yeah, I'm still not over on Noster. I'm gonna hang out on Twitter as long as possible out of laziness and ease of use. So I get you, man. It's all good. All right, yeah, if you're listening, you appreciate It is. It's always a good time, man. If you enjoyed the show, if you want to hear more about Nuclear Bitcoiner, go follow him at Nuclear Bitcoiner. That's good shit, man. If you want to find me, I'm at Sly Goomba. If you enjoyed the show, if you want to learn more, if you want to check out more, go check out more. If you want to, what do I say? If you want to support the show, just share it with a friend. Sharing is the easiest way to do that. All right. And as always, if ever, hey, if you're going to go out, if the world doesn't take on nuclear and everything goes to shit, at least you can still buy as much Bitcoin as you can before the end of the world. I would do that and learn. Keep learning, because that's what I'm doing. Dude, I felt my brain feels like it's a few sizes bigger after this one. I'm probably going to go back and listen to my own show just to try and absorb some more of this shit, because you had a lot of information. And
I always forget that, yeah, people don't know what. You know what? I've immersed myself in this stuff for 2 years now, and yeah, you forget.
It's hard to simplify it, right? It's hard to simplify it. Yeah, like, no, even absolutely. That, like, but that's
nuclear's an endless rabbit hole with very unique niches, and especially like careers in nuclear. You have the full spectrum. Like, you don't have to be like a nuclear engineer. You can do all kinds of stuff and end up in the nuclear industry. So, yeah,
right on.
I encourage people, if they want to be part of the future of humanity, nuclear is a good sector to explore. Thanks for having me.
Very cool, man. That's a good note to end it on. Appreciate you guys. See y'all next week. Peace.